And so one of the first things I knew we would have to do is to do something very different. Engage the individuals at the center of driving gunfire in our city. We'd have to be willing to be bold enough to confront a system and even a community that would ask the question, why invest in those individuals?
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. While other wealthy countries around the world are seeing their life expectancy rise, the U.S. is flatlining or even declining. In 2023, life expectancy in the U.S. was 4 years behind comparable countries. Why is that? Well, the gap is mainly due to what's called deaths and diseases of despair, or alcohol and drugs, suicide, accidents, and gun violence. We're circling back to that last issue in today's episode. I'm bringing you a conversation with two incredible people, Devon Bogan and Jason Corburn, who tackle gun violence on the ground in Richmond, California, a city that used to make headlines as Murder Capital USA. They went directly to the source to engage deeply with the Richmond residents who are most likely to pull the trigger. Once you hear this conversation, I really encourage you to go out and read their great new book, Advancing Peace. So please welcome Devon Bogan and Jason Corburn to The Other 80. Well, welcome to The Other 80. It's so great to have both of you on. The advantage of two guests who know each other well is I'm going to flip the script and ask you each to introduce the other person. So I'll start with you, Jason.
Okay. Devon Bogan is a dynamic leader, a thought partner, a change maker, a peacemaker around the world. This is a gentleman who has dedicated his life to human development, really, as we're going to talk about now. Not only, you know, is he a leader in this gun violence, community violence interruption space, but he's a leader just in a thought partner, I think, in California and nationally, on how we need to rethink public health, community development, and governance in really dynamic ways. And yeah, it's really been just a pleasure to work with my brother, Devon.
Good morning. Jason Corbin. Wow. What can I say about this dude? First, I have to say he's my brother and my friend, professor extraordinaire at my alma mater, University of California, Berkeley. The book that he and I have just co-authored doesn't happen without him. And he taught me a lot about what it means to put together something that I think we both agree will be very helpful, not only to the community violence intervention space, but also to the country as it relates to retaliatory gun violence that remains one of the most destructive realities in our country in terms of making it rare and less recurring. So I'm extremely proud to be a part of his life, a part of his family's life. And I would just say this for anybody wondering, this cat can get in the middle of an impacted neighborhood with the best of us and hold his own.
We'll hear from both of you how relational and trust-driven this work is. And it's highly aligned that you started with those words of trust and relationship with each other. I'm going to take us back, as the book does, to 2007, when Richmond was, by the count of gun violence, the third most dangerous city in the country. And the city council and the mayor and others in the city were grappling with this. And really, things could have gone different directions. Things could have gone a direction of increased police presence and punitive, highly punishing kind of approaches. What made it possible for that opening toward a different strategy in that moment in Richmond?
You know, I think the first person that I'd have to lift up as it relates to that is then Mayor Irma Anderson. I also think this impacted her reelection. She made a very moral decision as mayor to basically say, we're not going in all of those directions. So I think her leadership and her moral compass and her backbone to say, no, we're not going down that road. I've been down that road. I think she flat out said, I've been down that road with the likes of Martin Luther King Jr., her own husband, who was also mayor in earlier times in Richmond, and declaring that she wasn't going to support anything that would take us back to the 50s, 60s, or 70s with regard to how we work with community and support community. I think the second leadership piece that I would have to lift up was the community itself, who also said, we're unwilling to remain jaded or to at least do our best to check our jadedness in a healthy way, to work with the city, to work and have the city work with us as it relates to how we go about solving this problem, ending it, ending retaliatory gun violence as we know it today. That sort of galvanized more on the city council to embrace the opportunity as well. And then finally, I would say Bill Lindsay, the city manager at the time. He had come in new. He'd come in from Orinda, a city very different than Richmond, a suburb of the area. He had fresh lenses, something that perhaps others in the city and certainly on the city council may not have been able to tap into. That fresh lens made him a breath of fresh air. And he agreed that we should look to other kinds of opportunities and made a commitment to do it.
Jason, I'm curious, what were your views at the time on this new initiative starting and how that fit into that bigger narrative that you were creating?
Yeah, I mean, I got involved with the city of Richmond close to the same time Devone was creating the Office of Neighborhood Safety. So like he said, there was a lot of change, a lot within local government happening, somewhat a desire for something different, whether it was around air pollution, other environmental health issues, housing issues. And the number one issue was always gun violence. So community organizations and residents who were saying, hey, the drivers of health inequities is really one of our number one concerns, including violence. We want you to prioritize health in this redevelopment plan, in this general plan. And the ideas of community-driven solutions, a focus on health equity, a focus on root causes of the inequalities in that city, including the drivers of gun violence, became law, became documented into this general plan update chapter. Hundreds of cities now in California are copying Richmond to do the same thing. So, and remember again, Richmond doesn't have its own health department. It relies on the county. So these were one, again, of a number of innovations at the local government level to really lead and innovate. And I think just to pick up on Devone's comment, there were leaders, elected officials, and also really innovative community-based organizations and community leaders who were saying, we need to do something different.
Devone, you were then in a separate organization that had focused on mentoring, but your organization was asked to come in and do the landscape scan. And that involved a lot of conversations with people in other cities that were also tackling the same issues, but most importantly, conversations in the community of Richmond. What I found really interesting was you came away from that, picking up some of the elements of things from other cities, but also starting to really reconsider what that framework should look like based on what you were hearing locally. Can you just talk a little bit about what pieces really came clear to you in those conversations that needed to be addressed? And then next, we'll talk about the nuts and bolts of the program. What were the takeaways you had from those conversations that really became clear?
Yeah, it's a great question. The first thing that I recognized in traveling around the country where some of this work was being done, and also with an experience I was seeing play out in the city of Richmond, was that the very people at the center of firearm activity were not being engaged by anybody, or very few of them were. And I just found that to be challenging, because my mind kept going, well, if folks are hyper vigilant on engaging the people around the people that are responsible for driving gun violence, but not those who are driving the gun violence, that's very problematic, right? And that had to change. So I have to tell you, Claudia, that for me began this aha, we have to get at the people that are pulling the triggers. And that's problematic in a variety of ways, because these are the individuals that, quite frankly, many systems, particularly the criminal justice system, let me just be plain, I don't know if they're really interested in those people having or being provided an opportunity to change because, and I get it, they're trying to put these individuals in jail. So although law enforcement will say and agree they can't arrest their way out of this, and they understand the importance of going a little further upstream, even if it's just a tad bit upstream, they'd rather you not touch the people that they really believe are driving gun violence, because they're trying to make cases against those individuals. And I can understand that. But here's the problem with that. While you're trying to make cases on these individuals, and with greater law enforcement attention on these individuals, they remain involved in driving gun violence, and no one's getting at them. And so unless and until law enforcement can get these guys off the streets, we better have something else, something that's demonstrated success, something that's proven to be effective at slowing them down, if not completely changing their lives to where they now understand it isn't a healthy thing to do, nor is it a right thing to do to resolve your conflict with a firearm. And so one of the first things I knew we would have to do is to do something very different, and that is engage the individuals at the center of driving gunfire in our city. And we'd have to be willing to be bold enough to confront a system and even a community that would ask the question, why invest in those individuals? And our answer was because they most need those investments, and the communities most impacted by their destructive acts deserve for them to get it if it works to slow them down.
It's interesting how obvious what you said is, and I can appreciate the emotional consternation, because I'm sure people see around them so many people that have need. Not the only ones who have need. But if you're serious about making a change, you don't have any choice but to start there.
That's exactly right. And Claudia, understand, these individuals are what creates risk, or that at-riskness tag, for everybody else in the community. So if we can deal here effectively, less young people, less elderly people, less young children are at risk of dying at the hand of a bullet.
I would just say that insight from Devone, which is so critical, has been shown in other communities around the country, research and evaluation of small numbers of people driving the majority of gun violence, whether it's New York, Chicago, Baltimore. So it's, in other words, it's a manageable problem. It's not everybody who's in a hyper-segregated, racially discriminated, entrenched, impoverished neighborhood becomes someone who uses a firearm to resolve conflict. And so that was an important insight. I think it also, by seeing that these are people that deserve to be engaged, it shifts the conversation to public health, that we can see the humanity in these often young people who have are so disconnected, and often many are carrying unaddressed trauma, which is part, not the entire, but part of what's driving their response to conflict and continuing to engage in these rivalries and this retaliatory gun violence.
Yeah, Claudia, compassion without excuse. I love you enough to see your humanity and understand all of the things that have influenced your choices. But I also love you enough to tell you the truth about what's wrong with how you're responding to the conflicts that you're navigating.
I'd love to have the two of you lay out the basic framework, the basic model that you developed out of these insights. And just want to preface that with one observation that you mentioned, but is just so worth underscoring: how few of these folks who are at the center of violence were engaged in any system of care, meaning social services, meaning adult or other relationships, meaning even housing that was safe and secure. So what model and approach did you design coming out of all of these conversations and observations you'd made?
Yeah, you know, first and foremost, and this goes back to your earlier question, I wanted to blow their minds on life, Claudia. I mean, very simple. I figured I was dealing with, or our team, and we'd hear it a lot, dealing with an attitude of, I don't give a. And you can understand the end of that sentence. Starts with F, ends with K, right? I mean, just, I don't give a. And my whole point was, how do I get this person to give a little bit? Because if I can get him to give a little bit, I got him. And I understood the pull of the streets and the mountain and the steepness of that mountain that we were climbing. And so I knew that whatever we did had to counter that, or over-counter that, if I can say. I wanted to blow their minds on life, because I appreciated this. When one truly desires to live, better decisions are going to be made. Lives are going to be changed, and conditions are going to be created that can help transform a city. So we had to make sure that whatever we did helped these guys to make healthier decisions about what they were confronting every single day in those streets. But we had to make sure that everything we did communicated, we love you. We don't agree with the choices that you've made. We don't condone the choices that you've made, but we understand and we love you. And we understand how important you are to changing the reality in the city of Richmond. That was another big piece. Claudia, if you ask my team, they'll say, Devon was clear that we have to embrace the very individuals that we're talking about engaging as a part of the solution equation that we're trying to get to change the reality around gun violence in the country or in the city at the time. So we understood that we had to see them as a part of the solution, and we had to help tool them to bring out of them all of that that they could contribute to helping us to change the dynamics about gun violence in the city of Richmond. One of the things that I saw in some of the earlier work that I had witnessed is that folks were engaging at-risk individuals, but they were engaging them once a week, six times over 3 months. And I was like, wow, intermittent engagement can't be the solution. You've got to engage these guys every single day. We're going to do that. We're going to engage you and help you develop a life plan. And we can get into that, all of the deepness of that, if you want later. But essentially, if we can get you to start thinking beyond today, beyond tomorrow, beyond the week, beyond the month, beyond the year, then we're helping you live longer. We're helping you think about your life in longer term frames. And that became important. We're going to connect you with viable social service opportunities that we're going to vet before we take you there, because we understand that who you are, you're going to show up with a very different swag about yourself, and a swag that most people don't understand, quite frankly, maybe even afraid of. So we're going to help you navigate those social services that we deem important and legitimate and critical to helping you be successful. We're going to connect you with out-of-town opportunities. Why? Because we understand how important horizon building is. We understand how important it is to create space for you to take a deep breath, several deep breaths, as it relates to creating a healing space for you. We're going to provide for you a financial allowance that you can use to help stabilize a variety of things that's going on in your life that will keep you from making tough decisions, bad decisions about how to create stability in your life. We're going to encompass you within a circle of elders, folks that have seen the world that you're negotiating, have negotiated it successfully, and have now created successful lives for themselves and their families, and can give back to you. And we're going to find out what you believe you're good at, and when you're better prepared to fully take advantage of the opportunities, we're going to connect you to those opportunities, and we'll subsidize that for a period of time to make sure it's exactly what you believe you want to do with it. That was important to getting these young people to a place where they could be helpful to us in reducing gunfire in the city of Richmond. And it was in part driven by their voice. I think that's a critical piece. In our efforts to help them help us, we had to listen to them and learn from them about what could be helpful to them.
This only works if there are healthy adults with credibility to reach out to, often the folks who are at the center of gun violence. So the other key piece was identifying and recruiting what Devon calls neighborhood assets. These are folks from the neighborhoods where gun violence is happening who often have gone away to prison, often for very long sentences. And in that experience, have come back home with a new set of skills, highly skilled in conflict mediation, emotional intelligence, cognitive behavioral therapy, and are open to training themselves with others to raise their game to be able to do that kind of work, understanding the traumas that the young people that they're about to engage with have are now carrying, understanding the complexities of social service systems, and how frustrating they can be to anybody, but incredibly frustrating to someone who's been pushed out and marginalized and dehumanized for so long. So these are incredibly skilled workers, what the ONS and Devon called neighborhood change agents. These are often called violence interrupters. These are often called credible messengers. There's a long, long history of these folks. But critically, I think in this work, they have a new set of skills that we need to identify in public health. In fact, we're not, in my view, training our public health leaders enough to identify these assets. These folks engage individuals, they engage teams. So they're not just one-on-one engagement, but it's teamwork, that restorative work in groups. And also, they change communities, they change neighborhoods. There is no public space when People are in fear of gun violence. There's no parks that people are playing with. They're not using public transit. They're afraid to shop. They're not sleeping. Kids are not performing well in school. We know all these things. We've studied them in public health. The neighborhood change agents are critical to not just give that love and hope that Devon talked about for the folks at the center of gun violence, but they actually, and what we've shown in Richmond in particular, and in some of the other advanced peace cities, change the dynamic for the entire community. They change neighborhoods by bringing peace, by lowering the stress levels for everyone, and by changing the dynamics in the public space.
One of the things you alluded to, which I think is incredibly important, is the decision that was proposed by you, Devon, I think, and accepted by the mayor and others to not locate this new function within the criminal justice part of government. And I think you also talked about how that they have a role, if they're important, but it was not going to be possible to do the kind of work you described if the perception or the reality was that this was a function of criminal justice. And the other thing was you felt it was important that this actually be embedded in government and city government. Talk a little bit more about those two decisions.
Yeah. The first one with regard to where to embed this and keeping it separate from law enforcement became obvious to me. First and foremost, the folks that we're engaging in the communities where we engage them don't have a whole lot of trust for law enforcement. And there's a history, there's a variety of clear and present dangers that come with that. So it became clear that if we were going to have any chance of being able to engage the individuals at the center of retaliatory firearm violence, we were going to have to be separate and independent from law enforcement. Why? Because trust is our greatest credential. It's our cachet. It's our capital. And the moment that one of these individuals believes that somehow we are linked or tied to and or with law enforcement, it's done. It's as harsh. It's a hard stop. It's done. It's over. Not only is the work compromised in terms of it being done, but it also can create a very dangerous element akin to how a confidential informant may be seen in these same communities. Confidential informants work on behalf of the criminal justice system, and they aren't seen in a positive light. And so we understood that coming in, that the relationships are not strong. They're very fragile. There's not a whole lot of trust there. We're going to need these guys to trust us at the highest of high levels in order to break through these very hard shells that we're required to break through. So that was clear. I think one of the most important decisions and allowances that Bill Lindsay, the city manager at that time, made and gave was to allow me to hire formerly incarcerated individuals from the impacted communities, those folks that Jason just spoke of, as city government employees. That was the first time that had ever been done in the country. This was before Ban the Box. And again, not just formerly incarcerated individuals, because I'm certain that you got a lot of those and at that time had formerly incarcerated folks working inside government. But what you didn't have was a government seeking, deliberately and intentionally seeking, formerly incarcerated individuals to populate a city department but formerly incarcerated individuals with gun charges in their backgrounds from the very neighborhoods most impacted by gun violence in the city of Richmond. I believe and appreciate in the importance of this work sitting in community, and for a variety of reasons, but it's also got to sit in government. I've seen just how important it can become for the worker in terms of training and development, in terms of job security, in terms of competitive compensation. But here's a bigger reason for it. Try to imagine this, Claudia. I'm a community impacted by gun violence. And as a result of that, my relationship with my local government is tenuous at best. I mean, I don't trust it. I don't believe in it. I'm challenged by it. Now, more and more and more often, I'm seeing people that I know from this community representing government. They're a part of the government. They're doing important work. They're driving government cars. They are the government. People I know, people I trust. Think about how that impacts and improves that community's relationship with the government.
As I understand it, you now have 12 communities across the country, a lot in California, but also in other places, which means there were 12 conversations with city governments. What were some of the facts and stories that were most compelling in those repeated conversations in different cities? What brought them across the line and convinced them this was a good idea?
This takes political courage. And it takes an understanding that this doesn't get solved in an election term. So as an elected, you've got to be willing to say, you know what, I'm going to say yes to this in spite of being able to reap the reward of the positive results during my term in office. I think that our greatest demonstration has always been Richmond, always been the moment we implemented the Peacemaker Fellowship in 2010. Within 18 to 24 months after we did that, there were dramatic, precipitous reductions in gun violence. The moment we implemented this work and saw that initial cohort, that first cohort completed cycle, the city of Richmond hasn't turned back, right? When you get the right people to get at the right people the right way, over a long period of time, here's living proof, example, demonstration of what can happen. In 2014, we achieved a 40-year low in gun violence reductions. And since 2014, look at how dramatic the reductions have continued and have been sustained over the period. So the argument that we use that got folks to lean in the early days remains the argument today, even with greater conclusions. What I'm trying to say to cities still today is when you invest in community violence intervention work over a long term and you invest at scale, City of Richmond has made significant investments. Not only is it a publicly funded necessity like fire, EMS, and police, it is well funded, and there is a committed funding stream from government to it and has been since 2007. When you get there, here's what's possible.
Yeah, I would just say that those conversations of those dozen or more cities, so I think some of it is ensuring that the voices of the impacted people are communicated to these new cities, that you get the fellows or the participants to tell their stories of transformation and really the power of being confronted with, am I going to use this gun in this violent situation or not? very, very powerful stories from the participants themselves to share the impact. But often, you know, mayors and city council members and funders are like, yeah, okay, so what? You know, and they discount those as just, you know, ad hoc, few narratives. So we really try to bring in other information. For example, we're able to document all the times these outreach workers, these violence interrupters in every city go out and get in the middle of a gun conflict where guns are drawn. People are about to shoot one another potentially. And one or more of these outreach workers from Advance Peace, neighborhood change agents, get put their bodies on the line and literally get in the middle of that conflict, talk people down, use their intelligence and their skill often to mediate that conflict. They may even take that gun and walk away with it, drive that person away, pull that person away, take them, you know, down the street or even out of town. I mean, incredibly difficult, complicated, and dangerous work. And they're doing this day in and day out. We document in every city from Richmond to Fresno, Stockton, Orlando, Lansing, Michigan, across the country. In a year, these outreach workers are doing 30, 40, 50 or more, sometimes up to 100 of these interruptions of gun violence. Nobody knows about that, but these outreach workers and the communities themselves. The police never show up. It doesn't show up on anybody's database, but our work of trusting the outreach workers to document what they do gives us a data point to say, well, you know what? Each one of those conflicts that these folks are interrupted, if it was a shooting with an injury, probably would have cost your city or county somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million. And there's never appropriate to put a dollar value on a human life. But the reality is the, you know, the EMS is going to respond. The police are going to respond. There's going to be healthcare costs. There's going to be criminal justice investigation costs, or maybe incarceration costs, on and on and on. A homicide will cost that city $1 million to $1.5 million, maybe up to $2 million, depending on the city and the county. So these are costs that go to you and I. These are taxpayer dollars. And when Advance Peace workers interrupt one, two, five of those, you know, we can multiply by the likelihood that those being an injury shooting or a homicide that they prevented. So they're saving $5, $10, $40, $100 million in some cases through our estimates from these outreach engagements interrupting gun violence. That's a powerful data point that hopefully no council member, no mayor, no leader, no police chief can discount.
Claudia, I'm laughing because as Jason was talking about all of these things, I certainly wish he had gotten into Bill Lindsay's ear soon after he hired me, because what I didn't appreciate then, I certainly appreciate now. Bill said to me, I know you're going to bring a lot of good stuff to the city and with you being here, but if it doesn't translate into gunfire reduction, I'm going to fire you. You know, so I appreciate everything that Jay just said, and certainly, and I'm certain that Bill does now as well. But in the early days, it was definitely about, hey, you're here to help us reduce gunfire. If what you do doesn't translate into that, then you should start looking for another job. And quite frankly, I didn't like hearing it at the time. I do appreciate having heard it now and then being given the power and authority and some latitude to do some very innovative and creative things. I think we still have a long way to go as a society into turning the corner where this is embraced a little more palatably, if I may. And what I mean by that is that CVI, Community Violence Intervention today, is still, with all the numbers, and the numbers are phenomenal across the country and in very different contexts and different agencies doing this work and different strategies. But we still are fighting a huge law enforcement, American criminal justice footprint that is on the psychology or in the psychology of most voting Americans in this country. That tells them that law enforcement makes us safe, even when we can see that it doesn't.
somehow we've connected penalty with accountability when, in fact, the approach you're taking is deeply grounded in accountability. But without this sort of need to hold a hammer and a wedge against people. You recruited a bunch of leaders in their community and you said to them, I want to help you figure out how to channel this incredible strength to the good of all in your community. You saw in them such capacity for growth. And somehow, even though many people are, say they're Christian, I'm not sure everyone truly believes that there is that of love and God in all of us, you know? So somehow we say it, but we don't believe it.
Well, I'm glad you said it, because I think it's so critical when we talk about redemption value. These guys show up with assets that typically get ignored. And if you can if you can acknowledge the asset, see it, willing to dive into it, oh my God, there's so much to build from. And that's what we've learned, is that we're simply building from the assets that each and every one of these guys has. But even the fellows will tell you, and Jay's heard this, they understand if you're a fellow in our fellowship, you're a suspected active firearm offender. You've shot at someone and missed. You've shot at someone and injured them. You've shot at someone and perhaps killed them. You are a suspect in one or multiple of these kinds of events. You are thought to be a threat to the safety of the communities where you live or the broader city that you live in. Those are acts that have criminal consequences. So if you're a fellow, you understand that all we do is engage active firearm offenders who've avoided law enforcement reach. And quite frankly, you shouldn't be in the community, but you are. Even with greater law enforcement attention on you, you are in the community and still remain at the center of firearm activity. And even still, you have assets that we can tap into and build upon to get you to see yourself and your world differently in such a way that it powerfully influences the way you navigate conflict and the decisions you make as you're navigating conflict. It's all about helping these guys understand that they have choices and understand that they can make better decisions and putting an infrastructure around them that helps them to do that.
Let me just lift up that point real quick. I think what Devon is pointing to also is where we want to really call out the field of public health and public policy as it's really insufficient. It doesn't see a lot of the assets and strengths of our communities and folks in our communities. All we do is we look at risk factors, we look at disease, we look at death, and we measure bad stuff. But we do not as good or terrible job in recognizing all those assets for even those who are, you know, most dehumanized and disengaged. So we really want to center that front, put that at the front, because everybody brings that to the table, even in the most difficult circumstances. And we know that the idea is that there's more there that we can do. We limit ourselves as practitioners and interventionists and partners in change work by saying, okay, we just want to eliminate this disease. No, we want to move towards health. Well, what does that really mean? What do people who, you know, want to navigate through their world, they don't want to just think about their health. They want to be thinking about, you know, joy and having a fully fulfilled life with health being a part of getting us there, not the end, but a means to the end. And that's why we see this work as a means to an end of human development for and community improvement for everyone, and really movement towards justice.
That is an incredibly wonderful and beautiful way to wrap up what has been a great, great conversation. And just really want to highlight this amazing book that's coming out in October. For listeners, it'll be November by the time you listen to this. Advancing Peace, get it wherever you get your books, and filled with really powerful stories about this work in action. So just want to thank both of you so much for your work and for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah.
Many faiths have a version of the Quaker belief that God's light shines in every person. With emphasis on the every person part of that sentence, no one is excluded. And yet, so many of our policies and cultural practices are shaped by the opposite idea, that some people are deserving and others are not. We see it in opposition to clean needle programs, in the imposition of work requirements, and of course, it's built into the continued undermining of access to basic services. But even worse, beneath it all is a belief that some should simply be punished under the guise of justice. But we know from child psychology research to criminal justice studies, punishment does not work. So what does? For one, restorative practices. Or how about deep human engagement? What about strategies to address trauma, forgiveness, love? At the Clinton Global Initiative annual meeting, I heard an amazing Irish leader named Monica McWilliams talk about sitting at the peace negotiation table across from her boyfriend's killer. Through countless acts of courage and forgiveness like hers, Northern Ireland has achieved lasting peace. And listening to that talk on the heels of this interview with Devon and Jason, it really struck me that we need to banish the idea that some are deserving and others are not. We need to move away from punishment. Let's embrace the path of courage, forgiveness, love, and peace. This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore-Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information on Devon Bogan and Jason Korber. There is more information on my background, this podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time, I'm Claudia Williams.